than if I react out of the energy coming from my judgments. In many cases, however, another step needs to take place before we can expect the other person to connect with what's going on in us. Because it will often be difficult for others to receive our feelings and need in such situations, we often need to first empathize with them if we want them to hear us. The more we empathize with what leads others to behave in ways that are not meeting our needs, the more likely it is that they'll be able to reciprocate afterwards. Over the last 30 years, I've had a wealth of experience sharing nonviolent communication with people who harbor strong beliefs about specific races and ethnic groups. Early one morning, I was picked up by a cab at an airport to take me into town. A message from the dispatcher came over the loudspeaker for the cabbie. The message was, "Pick up Mr. Fishman at the synagogue on Main Street." There was another man sharing the cab with me, and he muttered, "These kikes get up early in the morning so they can screw everybody out of their money." For 20 seconds, there was smoke coming out of my ears. In earlier years, my first reaction would have been to want to physically hurt such a person. Now I took a few deep breaths, gave myself some empathy for the hurt, fear, and rage that were stirring inside of me. I listened to the feelings, but then I stayed conscious that my anger wasn't coming from what my fellow passenger nor the statement he had just made. Rather, I realized his comment had triggered off a volcano inside of me. I could see that my anger came from a deeper source than the judgment that made me angry. I sat back and simply allowed the violent thoughts to play themselves out. Giving myself this empathy enabled me then to focus my attention on the humanness behind his message. I wanted to see the beauty in him, to understand what was alive in him when he made that remark. I also wanted him to understand me and the pain that I felt, and I trusted that he would be better able to do that if he felt that I empathically connected with what was going on in him when he said what he did. I said, "Are you feeling frustrated because you have some needs that haven't been met when you've dealt with money with Jewish people?" He thought about that for a moment and said, "Yeah, these people are disgusting. They'll do anything for money." So I said, "If I'm understanding you, then you feel distrust and the need to protect yourself when you're involved in financial affairs with them." "That's right," he said. And he continued to release more judgments as I listened for the feeling and need behind each one. When we settle our attention on other people's feelings and needs, we experience our common humanity. When I hear that he's scared and wants to protect himself, I recognize that I have a need to protect myself at times. I know what it's like to be scared. So when my consciousness is focused on another person's feelings and needs, I see the universality of our experience. I had a major conflict with what went on in his head, of course. But I've learned that I enjoy human beings more if I don't get caught up in what they think in such situations. With people who are thinking in the way that he was, I've learned to savor life much more by only hearing what's going on in their hearts and not getting caught up with what's in their head. This man kept on pouring out his sadness and frustration. Before I knew it, he'd finished talking about Jews and moved on to people of color. He was charged with pain around a number of subjects. After nearly 10 minutes of my just listening, he stopped. He felt understood. Then I let him know what was going on in me. I said to him, "You know, when you first started to talk, I felt a lot of frustration and sadness and discouragement because I've had very different experiences with Jewish people than you've had, and I was wanting to share that I've had such different experiences. Can you tell me what you hear me saying right now?" And the man stopped for a moment and said, I'm not saying they're all..." I said, "Hold it, excuse me. Can you just tell me what you heard me say?" The man says, "What are you talking about?" I said, it's really important to me. I'd like you to really hear it, so I'd like to repeat it. I really want you just to hear the pain I felt when I heard your words. It's really important to me that you hear that. I was saying I felt a real sense of sadness because my experiences with Jewish people have been very different. I was just wishing that you had had some experiences that were different from the ones you were describing. Can you tell me what you heard me say? The man said, you're saying I have no right to talk the way I did. I say, thanks for telling me that's what you heard. I can see I didn't make myself clear. No, I'm not saying you had no right to talk that way. I was trying to say I'd like you to hear me differently than that. I don't want to blame you. I have no desire to blame you. I slowed down the conversation because, in my experience, to whatever degree people hear blame, they have failed to hear our pain. If this man said, in quotes, those were terrible things for me to say, those were racist remarks, I said, he would not have heard my pain. He would have heard blame and agreed with it. So as soon as people think they have done something wrong, they will not be fully apprehending our pain. I didn't want him to hear blame because I wanted him to know what was going on in my heart when he said what he did. Blaming is easy. People are used to hearing blame. Sometimes they agree with it and hate themselves. That doesn't stop them from behaving the same way. And sometimes they hate us for calling them whatever we did, which also doesn't stop their behavior. If we sense blame entering our mind, as I did in the cab, we may need to slow down, go back, and hear their pain for a while more. I tried again to express my pain, and I could see that I maybe was expressing it in a more complicated way than I had to, so I tried to make it as simple as I could, and he was then able to reflect back what he heard me say. And as I got out of the cab, I thought we had made a superficial connection, but one that was far better than would have come about if I had started to communicate with him out of anger and the judgments that were causing my anger. Probably the most important part of learning how to live the process I have just been discussing about anger is to take our time. We may feel awkward deviating from the habitual behaviors that our conditioning has rendered automatic. But if our intention is to consciously live life in harmony with our values, then we'll want to take our time. A friend of mine jotted down the basic components of this process on a 3x5 card, which he would use as a kind of a cheat sheet at work. When his boss would confront him, he would stop, refer to the card in his hand, and take time to remember how to respond. When he told me this, I asked him whether his colleagues were finding him a little strange, constantly staring into his hand and taking so much time to respond. He said, Marshall, it doesn't actually take that much more time, but even if it did, it's still worth it to me. It's important for me to know that I'm responding to people the way I want to, rather than how I've been trained to. At home, he was even more overt. He explained to his wife and children why he was taking the time and why he consulted the card. Whenever there was an argument in the family, he would pull out the card and take his time, focus his attention where he wanted it to be, using the card as a reminder. He told me that after about a month, he felt comfortable enough with the process to not have to use the card, and he put it in his drawer. And one evening shortly afterwards, he and his son Scotty, age 4, were having a conflict over the television, and it wasn't going too well, and Scotty said, Daddy, get the card. For those of you wishing to live nonviolent communication, especially in challenging situations that stimulate anger, I would suggest the following exercise. As we've seen, our anger comes from judgments, labels, and thoughts of blame, of what people should do and what they deserve. List the judgments that float most frequently in your head by using the cue, I don't like people who are. And then list what thoughts come to you. Collect these negative judgments in your head, and for each one then ask, when I make that judgment of a person, what might I be needing at that moment that's being expressed through that judgment? In this way, you train yourself to frame your thinking in terms of unmet needs rather than in terms of judgments. practice is essential because most of us were raised, if not in the streets of Detroit as I was, then somewhere only slightly less violent. Judging and blaming may have become second nature to us. So to practice nonviolent communication, we need to proceed slowly, to take our time before we speak, and often to take a breath and not speak at all. Learning the process and applying it both take some time. During my practice as a psychotherapist, I was once contacted by the parents of a 20-year-old woman under psychiatric care who, for several months, had been undergoing medication, hospitalization, and shock treatments. She had become mute 3 months before her parents contacted me. When they brought her to my office, she had to be assisted because, left to herself, she just sat and stared at the floor. In my office, she crouched in her chair, shaking, her eyes on the floor. I tried to connect empathically with what feelings and needs were being expressed through her nonverbal message. I said to her, "I'm sensing you're really scared. You have a need for safety, need to be sure that if you talk, you'll be safe. Is that accurate?" She didn't respond verbally. She just sat there. I said, "I'm guessing that it's scary even to talk. Is that so?" She continued sitting there. Then I expressed my own feelings, saying, "I'm very concerned about you, and I would like to contribute some way to helping you feel more safe. I'd like you to tell me if there's something I could say or do that would make you feel safe." Still no verbal response. For the next 40 minutes, I continued to either reflect the feelings and needs I sensed were being expressed through her silence, or at other times I expressed my feelings and needs. There was no verbal response. Finally, after about 40 minutes, I said, "Oh, I'm feeling really tired right now, need some rest. How about if we get together tomorrow? Would you be willing to do that?" I got no verbal response from her, and so I said, "Well, if I don't hear you say anything, I'll assume it's okay, and I'll ask your parents to bring you back tomorrow." The next day was like the first day. I continued to hear through her silence what I guessed she was feeling, needing. I told her at times my feelings and needs, but she still didn't respond verbally. Third day the same. Fourth day the same. This time, when she didn't respond, I reached over and held her hand. Not knowing whether my words were communicating my concern, I hoped the physical contact might do so more effectively. At first contact, her muscles tensed and she shrank further back into her chair. I was about to release her hand when I sensed a slight yielding, so I kept my hold on her hand. After a few moments, I noticed a progressive relaxation on her part. I held her hand for several minutes while I talked to her as I had the first few days, but still she said nothing. When she arrived the next day, she appeared even more tense than before. But this time a new message. She extended a clenched fist toward me while turning her face away from me. She kept moving the fist toward my face. I was at first confused by the gesture. I said to her, "Are you feeling angry and just want me to leave you alone and not ask your parents to bring you here each day?" And now she shook her head no, but that wasn't what she wanted, and this was the first time I got a response other than silence. But she still kept pushing the fist toward me, and I said, "Well, I'm not understanding what you mean by this." Finally, I understood that she had in her fist a message for me. I pried open her fingers. There was a message that said, "Please help me express what's going on inside myself." I was elated to receive this sign of her desire to communicate. Still, it took another hour of my empathizing with how scary it was for her to talk. She finally expressed the first sentence, slowly and fearfully. When I reflected back what I heard her saying, she appeared relieved and continued slowly and fearfully to talk. A year later, she sent me a copy of the following entries from her journal. Here's what she wrote. I came out of the hospital away from shock treatments and strong medicine. That was about April. The 3 months before that are completely blank in my mind, as well as the 3.5 years before April. They say that after getting out of the hospital, I went through a time at home of not eating, not talking, and wanting to stay in bed all the time. Then my parents took me to Dr. Rosenberg. I don't remember much of those first 2 or 3 months other than being in his office and talking with him. I'd begun waking up since that first session with him. And when I began sharing with him things that bothered me, things that I never have dreamed of telling anyone about, and I remember how much that meant to me. It was so hard to talk. But Dr. Rosenberg cared about me and showed it, and I wanted to talk with him. I was always glad afterwards that I had let something out. I remember counting the days, even the hours, until my next appointment with him. I've also learned that facing reality is not all bad. I'm realizing more and more of the things that I need to stand up to, things that I need to get out and do on my own. This is scary, and it's very hard, and it's so discouraging that when I'm trying really a lot, I can still fail so terribly. But the good part of reality is that I've been seeing that it includes wonderful things, too. I've learned in the past year about how wonderful it can be to share myself with other people. I think it was mostly just one part of what I learned about the thrill of my talking to other people and have them actually listen, even really understand at times. I continue to be amazed by the healing power of empathy. Time and time again, I have witnessed people transcending the paralyzing effects of psychological pain when they have sufficient contact with someone who can hear them empathically. As listeners, we don't need insight into psychological dynamics or training in psychotherapy. What is essential is our ability to be present to what is alive in the other person, to the feelings and needs they're experiencing at that very moment. I have been discussing how nonviolent communication can connect us with our friends, family, people at work, even be used in the political arena. However, its most crucial application in many ways may be in the way we treat ourselves. When we're internally violent toward ourselves, it's difficult to be genuinely compassionate toward others. I like the way Mahatma Gandhi said it. Let us become the change we seek in the world. When we have been taught to be judgmental toward ourselves, this prevents us from seeing the beauty in ourselves. We lose connection with the divine energy that is our source. Conditioned to view ourselves as objects, objects full of shortcoming, is it any wonder that many of us end up relating violently to ourselves? An important area where this violence can be transformed into compassion is in our moment-to-moment evaluation of ourselves. Since we want whatever we do to lead to the enrichment of life, it's critical to know how to evaluate events and conditions in ways that help us learn from them and make ongoing choices that serve us, without ever losing self-respect. Unfortunately, the way we've been trained to evaluate ourselves often promotes more self-hatred than learning. In a routine workshop activity, I ask participants to recall a recent occasion when they did something they wished they hadn't done. We then look at how they spoke to themselves immediately after having made what is referred to in common language as a mistake, an error. Typical statements that people tell me they make of themselves when they are less than perfect sound like this. That was dumb. Or how could you do such a stupid thing? Or what's wrong with you? Or you're always messing things up. Or that was a selfish thing to do. These people have been taught to judge themselves in ways that imply that what they did was wrong or bad. Their self-admonishment implicitly assumes that they deserve to suffer for what they've done. I consider it tragic that so many of us get enmeshed in self-hatred rather than benefit from mistakes which show us our limitations and guide us toward growth. As I say in our workshops, please don't try to be perfect at nonviolent communication. Try to become progressively less stupid. If you want to be perfect at anything, if you make a mistake, it's a catastrophe. So what do people do when they're perfectionists? They don't try, because they might mess it up. They live by the philosophy, you can't fall out of bed if you sleep on the floor. Or as this was expressed by the aunt of someone in a workshop of mine. She said, my aunt said it this way, Marshall. Anything that's worth doing is worth doing poorly. So I'd like us to learn from our limitations this way, not as something that's wrong with us, but, okay, here's a learning opportunity. How can I learn from this? How can I evolve from this? Even when we do learn a lesson from mistakes for which we judge ourselves harshly, I worry about the nature of the energy behind that kind of change in learning. I'd like change to be stimulated by a clear desire to enrich life for ourselves and others, rather than by destructive energies such as shame or guilt. If the way we evaluate ourselves leads us to feel shame and we constantly change our behavior, we allow our growing and learning to be guided by self-hatred. Shame is a form of self-hatred, and actions taken in reaction to shame are not free and joyful acts. Even if our intention is to behave with more kindness and sensitivity, if people sense shame or guilt behind our actions, they're less likely to appreciate what we do than if we are motivated purely by the human desire to contribute to life. In our language, there is a word with enormous power to create shame and guilt. This violent word, which we commonly use to evaluate ourselves, is so deeply ingrained in our consciousness that many of us would have trouble imagining how to live without it. It is the word should, as in, I should have known better, or I shouldn't have done that, or I should do this. Most of the time when we use this word with ourselves, we resist learning because should implies there's no choice. Human beings, when hearing any kind of demand, tend to resist it because it threatens our autonomy, our strong need for choice. We have this reaction to tyranny even when it's internal tyranny in the form of a should we're expressing to ourselves. A similar expression of internal demand occurs in the following self-evaluation. What I'm doing is just terrible. I really must do something about it. Think for a moment of all the people you've heard say, I really should give up smoking, or I really have to do something about exercising more. They keep saying what they must do, have to do, should do, and they keep resisting doing it. Because we human beings were not meant to be slaves. We were not meant to succumb to the dictates of should and have to, whether they come from inside or outside of ourselves. And if we do yield and submit to these demands, our actions arise from an energy that is devoid of life-giving joy. When we communicate with ourselves on a regular basis through inner judgment, blame, and demand, it's not surprising that our self-concept gives in to feeling more like a chair than a human being. A basic premise of nonviolent communication is that whenever we imply that someone is wrong or bad, what we're really saying is that he or she is not acting in harmony with our needs. If the person we are judging happens to be ourselves, what we're saying is, I myself am not behaving in harmony with my own needs. I'm convinced that if we learn to evaluate ourselves in terms of whether or how well our needs are being fulfilled, we are much more likely to learn from the evaluation without losing self-respect. Our challenge, then, when we are doing something that's not enriching life, is to evaluate ourselves moment by moment in a way that inspires change, both, one, in the direction of where we would like to go, and two, out of respect and compassion for ourselves rather than out of self-hatred, guilt, or shame. After a lifetime of schooling and socialization, it's probably too late for most of us to train our minds to think judgmental. However, just as we've learned to translate judgments when judgmental self-talk, and to immediately focus our attention on the underlying needs. For example, if we find ourselves reacting reproachfully to something we did and say to ourselves something like, look, you just messed up again, we can quickly stop and ask ourselves, hold it now. What unmet need of mine is being expressed through this statement? When we do connect to the need, and there may be several layers of needs, we will notice a remarkable shift in our bodies. Instead of the shame, guilt, or depression we likely feel when criticizing ourselves for having messed up again, we will experience any number of feelings, but they'll be different kinds of feelings, feelings that some people refer to as a sweet pain. Whether it's sadness, frustration, disappointment, fear, grief, or some other feeling that we have been endowed by nature with for the purpose of helping us to better meet our needs, it will be a different energy that we have than when we have the feelings that come from judging and blaming ourselves, the feelings of guilt, shame, and depression. Mourning in nonviolent communication is a phrase I use to refer to the process of fully connecting with the unmet needs and feelings that are generated when we have been less than perfect. It is an experience of regret, but regret that helps us learn from what we have done without blaming or hating ourselves. We see how our behavior ran counter to our own needs and values, and we open ourselves to feelings that arise out of that awareness. When our consciousness is focused on what we need, we are naturally stimulated toward the creative possibilities of how to get that need met. In contrast, the moralistic judgments we use when blaming ourselves tend to obscure such possibilities and to perpetuate a state of self-punishment. We follow up on the process of mourning with self-forgiveness. Turning our attention to the part of ourself which chose to act in the way that led to what we're calling a mistake, we ask ourselves, when I behaved in the way which I now regret, what need of mine was I trying to meet by doing that? I believe that human beings are always acting in the service of needs and values. This is true whether the action does or does not meet the need, or whether it's one we end up celebrating or regretting. When we listen empathically to ourselves, we will be able to hear the underlying need. Self-forgiveness occurs the moment this empathic connection is made. Then we can recognize that our choice was an attempt to serve life, even as the mourning process teaches us how it fell short of fulfilling all of our needs. An important aspect of self-compassion is to be able to empathically hold both parts of ourselves, the self that regrets a past action, and the self that took the action in the first place with the intention of meeting our needs. The process of mourning and self-forgiveness free us in the direction of learning and growing. In connecting moment by moment to our needs, we increase our creative capacity to act in harmony with them. I have been sharing with you how we answer what's alive in us using nonviolent communication. And we saw that this was centered on our needs. Now I'm going to shift to another critical question that nonviolent communication tries to address, and that's how to express what we would like others to do to make life more wonderful for us. How to make requests, in other words, that are gifts to people rather than heard as demands. Because when people hear our request and see it solely as an opportunity to contribute to our well-being, it gives them this opportunity to do what we human beings love more than anything else, to use our power in the service of life. The same request, if the person hears it as a demand, is quite a different thing. Then it threatens their autonomy, and if they do what we're asking, we'll pay for it because it's not coming out of compassion or a desire to enrich life, but out of fear that they will be punished, rejected, guilted, shamed, or something like that. So I'll first talk with you about how we can make the requests clear, and then what we can do to help the other person see that they are requests and not demands. After we have expressed our observations, feelings, needs to the other person, we follow it with a specific statement telling them what we would like them to do to contribute to our well-being. To do this, I recommend using positive action language. And let's first look at what I mean by positive language. This means saying what we do want rather than what we don't want. I like how my friend Ruth put this in a song she wrote for children. She says in the song, "How do you do a don't? All I know is I feel won't when I'm told to do a don't." These lyrics reveal two problems commonly encountered when requests are worded in the negative. First, people are often confused as to what is wanted. And second, when we say what we don't want, we negate something the person's doing. It often is heard by them as a criticism of what they're doing. During the Vietnam War, I was asked to debate the war issue on television with a man whose position differed from mine. This program was videotaped, so I was able to go home and watch it that evening. When I saw myself on the screen communicating in ways I didn't want to be communicating, I felt very upset. And I said to myself, if I'm ever in another discussion like that, I'm determined not to do what I did on that program. I'm not going to be defensive. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. There were three things that I had real clearly seen there that I didn't want to do when I discuss things with people with whom I disagree. So notice I was saying to myself what I didn't want, not getting clear what I did want to do. Well, a week later, I was invited to be on the same program and continue the debate with this gentleman. All the way down to the studio, I repeated to myself the things I didn't want to do. I don't want to do A, I don't want to do B, I don't want to do C. As soon as the program started, he came at me the way he had the previous time, and for about 10 seconds I didn't do A, B, and C. I just sat there because I hadn't been clear how I did want to communicate. And as soon as I did open my mouth, I made up for the lost 10 seconds, and I came out with what I had been doing the week before even worse. So this was a painful lesson to me about how important it is not just to get clear what you don't want, but how to be very clear what you do want to do, and how to practice it until you can transform the old into the new. I was once invited to work with some black high school students who suffered a long litany of grievances against their principal. They regarded the principal as a racist. A minister who worked closely with the young people noted how angry they were with him, and he was afraid of where their anger was taking them. And he knew of my work, and he suggested that the students spend some time with me. When we got together, They began by describing what they saw as discrimination on the part of the principal. They gave me several examples. After listening to what they said, I suggested that they get clear what they would like him to do differently. One of the students was pretty skeptical that that would help. The student said to me, "What good would that do? We went to him one time and told him what we wanted. His answer to us was, 'Get out of here. I don't need you people telling me what to do.'" I asked, "What did you ask of him at that time?" They recalled saying to him that they didn't want him telling them how to wear their hair. I suggested they might have received a different response if they had expressed what they did want rather than what they didn't want. They then told me that they had said to the principal that they wanted to be treated with fairness, and then they said he got real defensive when they said that. He denied that he had ever been unfair. I ventured to guess that the principal might have responded differently if they had asked for specific actions, rather than expressing their request vaguely by saying what they wanted fair treatment. Working together, we found ways to express their requests in positive action language. At the end of the meeting, they clarified 38 different things that they wanted to request of the principal, including such things as, "We'd like you to agree to black student representation on decisions made about dress code." "And we'd like you to refer to us as black students and not you people." They went in, expressed these 38 things to him. They called me up that evening and they were thrilled. He agreed to all 38. We've all learned things that limit us as human beings. Whether from well-intentioned parents, teachers, clergy, or others, or from the media, we've learned some things that are not very good for us at all. Passed down through generations, even centuries, much of this destructive learning is so ingrained in our lives that we're no longer conscious of it. In one of his routines, comedian Buddy Hackett, raised on his mother's rich cooking, claimed that he never realized it was possible to leave the table without feeling heartburn until he was in the army. He was so accustomed to his mother's cooking that heartburn had become a way of life. In the same way, pain engendered by damaging cultural conditioning is such an integral part of our lives that we're often no longer distinguishing its presence. It takes tremendous energy and awareness to recognize this destructive learning and transform it into thoughts and behaviors that are of value and of service to life. This requires a literacy of needs and the ability to get in touch with ourselves, both of which can be difficult if we have gone through some cultural training that teaches us not to be connected to ourselves. Not only have we never been educated to be literate about our needs, we're often exposed to cultural training that actively blocks our consciousness. As mentioned earlier, we've inherited a language that served kings and powerful elites in domination societies. The masses, discouraged from developing awareness of their own needs, have instead been educated to be nice, dead people. Our culture implies that needs are negative and destructive. The word needy applied to a person suggests inadequacy or immaturity. When people express their needs, they're often labeled selfish, and the use of the personal pronoun I is at times equated with selfishness or neediness. By encouraging us to separate observation and evaluation, to acknowledge the thoughts or needs shaping our feelings, and to express our requests in clear action language, nonviolent communication heightens our awareness of the cultural conditioning influencing us at any moment. And drawing this conditioning into the light of consciousness is a key step in breaking its hold on us. We can apply nonviolent communication to resolve the internal conflicts that often result in depression. In his book, Revolution in Psychiatry, Ernest Becker attributes depression to cognitively arrested alternatives. To me, this means that when we have a judgmental dialogue going on within, we become alienated from what we are needing and cannot then act to meet those needs. Depression, then, is indicative of a state of alienation from our own needs. A woman studying nonviolent communication was suffering a profound bout of depression. She was asked to identify the voices within her when she felt the most depressed, and to write them down in dialogue form, as though they were speaking to each other. The first two lines of her dialogue were Voice 1, which was labeled by her Career Woman. I should do something more with my life. I'm wasting my life. I'm wasting my education. I'm wasting my talents. Voice 2, which she labeled Responsible Mother, said to her, You're being unrealistic. You're a mother of two children. You can't handle that responsibility. So how can you handle anything else? Notice how these inner messages are infested with judgmental terms and phrases such as should, wasting my education and talents, etc. Variations of this dialogue have been running for months in the woman's head. She was then asked to imagine the career woman voice taking a course in nonviolent communication and thinking what it would be said if she could say it in terms of her feelings and needs. She subsequently translated, I should do something with my life, I'm wasting my education and talents, into, when I spend as much time at home with the children as I do without practicing my profession, I feel discouraged because I'm really needing the fulfillment I once had in my profession. Therefore, I now would like to find some part-time work in my profession. Then it was the turn of her voice, Responsible Mother, to undergo the same process. The lines, You're being unrealistic. You're a mother of two children and can't handle that responsibility. So how can you handle anything else? Were transformed into, When I imagine going to work, I feel scared because I'm needing reassurance that the children will be well taken care of. Therefore, I would now like to plan how to provide high-quality child care while I work, and also how to find sufficient time to be with the children when I'm not tired. This woman felt great relief as soon as she translated her inner messages in this way. She was able to get beneath the alienating messages she was repeating to herself and offer herself empathy. Although she still faced practical challenges, such as securing quality child care and her husband's support, she was no longer subject to the judgmental internal dialogue that kept her from being aware of her own needs and for taking actions to meet her needs. When we're entangled in critical, blaming, or angry thoughts, it is difficult to establish a healthy internal environment for ourselves. Nonviolent communication helps us create a more peaceful state of mind by encouraging to have just invested not really wanting, rather than on what is wrong with ourselves or others. We deny responsibility for our actions when we attribute their cause to vague, impersonal forces, such as, I cleaned my room because I had to, or our condition, diagnosis, personal or psychological history. An explanation of this kind would sound like this. I drink because I'm an alcoholic. Or we attribute our behavior to the actions of others, such as, I hit my child because he ran into the street. Or we attribute our behavior to the dictates of authority, saying things like, I lied to the client because the boss told me to. Or we blame group pressure, saying things like, I started smoking because all my friends did. Or we attribute our behavior to institutional policies, rules, and regulations, saying things like, I have to suspend you for this infraction because it's policy of our organization. Or we blame gender roles, social roles, or age roles for our behavior, saying things like, I hate going to work, but I do it because I'm a husband and a father. Or we say our behavior was caused by uncontrollable impulses, saying things like, I was overcome by my urge to eat the candy bar. See, when we do things not out of the pure joy of contributing to life, but when our language tricks us into feeling that we are compelled to do it by outside forces, it doesn't make life very enjoyable. And anything we do out of that kind of energy, everybody pays for it. Another time I was consulting with a school district, and a teacher said to me, I hate giving grades. I don't think they're helpful, and they create a lot of anxiety on the part of students. But I have to give grades. It's district policy. We had just been practicing how to introduce language in the classroom that heightens consciousness of responsibility for one's actions. I suggested that the teacher translate the statement, I have to give grades because it's district policy, to, I choose to give grades because I want, and then I ask her to fill in that blank. What are you wanting that makes you give the grades? She answered without hesitation, I choose to give grades because I want to keep my job. And then she hastened to add, but I don't like saying it that way. It makes me feel so responsible for what I'm doing. I told her that's why I've thought for a long time now. I share the sentiments of French novelist and journalist George Bernanos when he says, I've thought for a long time now that if someday the increasing efficiency for the technique of destruction finally causes our species to disappear from the earth, it will not be cruelty that will be responsible for our extinction, and still less, of course, the indignation that cruelty awakens and the reprisals and vengeance that it brings upon itself. But the docility, the lack of responsibility of the modern person, their subservient acceptance of every common decree. The horrors that we've seen and the still greater horrors we shall presently see are not signs that rebels, insubordinate, untamable people are increasing in number throughout the world, but rather that there is a constant increase in the number of obedient, docile people. Now, there are some other forms of communication that I'm also concerned about because of how I see them disconnecting us from life. Communicating our desires as demands is another form of such communication. A demand explicitly or implicitly threatens the other person with blame or punishment if they fail to comply. It's a common form of communication in our culture, unfortunately, especially among those who hold positions of authority. My own children gave me some invaluable lessons about demands. Somehow I'd gotten it into my head that as a parent my job was to make demands. I learned, however, that I could make all the demands in the world, but this still couldn't make the children do what I wanted them to do. This is a humbling lesson in power for those of us who believe that because we're a parent, teacher, or manager, our job is to change other people and make them behave. So here were my children letting me know that I couldn't make them do anything. All I could do was make them wish they had. Life-alienating communication is also a wish they had. They would make me wish. Life-alienating communication is also associated with the concept that certain actions merit reward while others merit punishment. This thinking is expressed by the word deserve, as he deserves to be punished for what he did. It assumes badness on the part of people who behave in certain ways and calls for punishment to make them repent and change their behavior. I believe it's in everyone's interest that people change, not in order to avoid punishment, but because they see the change as helping them to enrich life. I've just outlined some ways of communicating that I would suggest that we transform. Moralistic judgments of others, statements that deny responsibility for our actions, statements that blame our feelings on others. I'd also like to suggest that if we use punishment and reward to motivate other people, I'm concerned about that. I'm confident we wouldn't use punishment and reward as means of influencing people if we ask ourselves two questions. Question one, what would we like the other person to do differently? Now, if we ask only that question, it makes punishment seem like an effective strategy, because we can probably all think of times when we have been influenced to do something out of a threat of punishment, or we have been able to get other people to do things out of a threat of punishment. But if we add to this question, what do we want other people to do differently? We add this question, what do we want their reasons to be for doing what we are requesting that they do? I think it will become obvious to us that punishment is a losing game. Punishment reinforces the idea of violence as a way of getting what we want from other people. When people do things out of a threat of punishment, we become a source of punishment, and the more people associate us in that way, the harder compassionate giving is for them to engage in. Now, that's not easy for people to consider giving up punishment, because they have this idea that unless we have punishment, we'll have social disorder, people will just do whatever they want to do, we'll have chaos, anarchy. They don't realize that there are other ways of keeping social order beside the threat of punishment. But even though they can somehow see that punishment leads to more violence, it's hard for them to see the problem with rewards. It looks to them like rewarding people for doing what we want is a natural way of doing things. But here again, in nonviolent communication, we would like people to do things because of the intrinsic, the basic value of doing it in terms of how it enriches life. We want that to be what motivates people to act as they do, not to get some extrinsic reward from other people. Now, of all of the extrinsic rewards that concern me, one of the ones that I'm most concerned about is the use of praise and compliments to try to get people to continue doing what they are doing that we like that they do. I'll speak of that later on, except that I want at the moment just to include praise and compliments as part of this rewarding people to do what we want. I'm sure people would never use rewards again if they read Alfie Kohn's book, Punished by Rewards, in which he shows all of the problems that are created when we try to get order or get people to do things out of rewards. Many years ago, after having just invested 9 years of my life in the training and diplomas necessary to qualify as a psychotherapist, I came across a dialogue between the Israeli philosopher Martin Buber and the American psychologist Carl Rogers, in which Buber questions whether anyone could do psychotherapy in the role of a psychotherapist. Buber was visiting the United States at the time and had been invited, along with Carl Rogers, to a discussion at a mental hospital in front of a group of mental health professionals. In this dialogue, Buber states that human growth occurs through a meeting between two individuals who express themselves vulnerably and authentically, in which he termed an I-thou relationship. He didn't believe that this type of authenticity was likely to exist when people meet in the roles of psychotherapist and client. Rogers agreed that authenticity was a prerequisite to growth. He maintained, however, that enlightened psychotherapists could choose to transcend their own role and encounter their clients authentically. Buber was skeptical. He was of the opinion that even if psychotherapists were committed and able to relate to their clients in an authentic fashion, Such encounters would be impossible as long as the clients continued to view themselves as clients and their psychotherapists as psychotherapists. He observed how the very process of making appointments to see someone at an office, paying fees, how this dimmed the likelihood of an authentic relationship developing between two people. This dialogue clarified my own long-standing ambivalence toward clinical detachment, a sacrosanct rule in the psychoanalytic psychotherapy I was taught. To bring one's own feelings and needs into the psychotherapy was typically viewed as a sign of pathology on the part of the therapist. Competent psychotherapists, according to this way of thinking, were to stay out of the therapy process by bringing themselves into it, and to function as a mirror onto which clients projected their transferences, which were then worked through with the psychotherapist's help. I understood the theory behind keeping the psychotherapist's inner process out of psychotherapy and guarding against the danger of addressing internal conflicts at the client's expense. However, I had always been uncomfortable maintaining the requisite emotional distance, and furthermore believed in the advantages of bringing oneself authentically into the process. I thus began to experiment by replacing clinical language with the language of nonviolent communication. Instead of interpreting what my clients were saying in line with personality theories I had studied, I made myself present to their words and listened empathically. Instead of diagnosing them in my thinking, I revealed what was going on within myself. At first, this was frightening. I worried about how colleagues would react to the way with which I was entering into dialogue with the clients. However, the results were so gratifying to both the clients and myself that I soon overcame any hesitation. Since about 1963, the concept of bringing myself fully into the client-centered relationship has ceased seeming heretical to me. But when I began practicing this way, I was often invited to speak by groups of psychotherapists who were not too comfortable when I would bring this up. Once I was asked by a large gathering of mental health professionals at a state mental hospital to show how nonviolent communication might serve in counseling distressed people. After my one-hour presentation, I was requested to interview a patient in order to produce an evaluation and recommendation for treatment. I talked with this 29-year-old mother of three children for about half an hour. After she left the room, the staff responsible for her care posed their questions. "Dr. Rosenberg," her psychiatrist began, "please make a differential diagnosis. In your opinion, is this woman manifesting a schizophrenic reaction, or is this a case of drug-induced psychosis?" I said that I was uncomfortable with such questions. Even when I worked in a mental hospital during my training, I was never sure how to fit people into these classifications. Since then, I've read research indicating a lack of agreement among psychiatrists and psychologists regarding these terms. Reports conclude that diagnoses of patients in mental hospitals depends more upon the school the psychiatrist attended than the characteristics of the patients themselves. "I would be reluctant," I continued, "to apply these terms even if consistent usage did exist, because I failed to see how they benefited patients. In physical medicine, pinpointing the disease process that has created the illness often gives clear direction to its treatment. But I didn't perceive this relationship in the field we call mental illness. In my experience during case conferences at hospitals, the staff would spend most of its time deliberating over a diagnosis. The psychiatrist in charge of the case might appeal to the others for help in setting up a treatment plan. Often this request would be ignored in favor of continued wrangling over the diagnosis." When I was asked this question in the group that I was talking to about what diagnosis I had of this woman, I explained to the psychiatrist that nonviolent communication suggests that I ask to myself the following questions rather than to think in terms of what is wrong with the patient. Questions such as, what is the person feeling? What is she needing? How do I feel in response to this person? What are my needs behind my feelings? What action or decision would I request this person to take in the belief that it might enable this person to live more happily?